How's it going?
Oh, man. Absolutely nothing happening this
Happy
week.
Happy Friday.
Very boring week.
How'd you make it through the week?
My week was kind of crazy, man. I've had a lot of work going on, sort of traditional
work.
You
didn't work, dude. You're a venture capitalist.
That's why I thought someone asked me if I was skiing this week. And the answer is absolutely not. I've had a lot of things culminating at once. Traditional work, some solar maxing, some MSTR maxing, which we'll talk about later. We had the builder meetup, which was awesome. I also went with the Vora guys to go see Deltron 3030. So that's a little bit of underground hip hop alpha right there. It was pretty
That was last night, right?
It was two nights ago. It's been a busy week. It was awesome. I think Dan the Automator, who's like their sort of producer, every project he's touched has been just gold. So a lot of people don't realize this. They'll probably know him most as the producer behind Gorillaz. But he's also behind Handsome Boy Modeling School, Dr. Octagon, all kinds of really great stuff. So it was fabulous.
Great. Well, for the more normie boomer music taste, I've got to recommend the Billy Joel documentary. I was telling Steve about this. Have you seen this?
Definitely not.
You know who Billy Joel is? Have you heard of him? I'm a pianist, so I love this kind of. I've been a big fan of him for a long time. But
we're having fun here, ladies and gentlemen. Don't worry.
He's got a new documentary, a kind of autobiography of his life, you know. First episode came out last week. Second episode comes out today, I think. And it was great. I've been recommending anybody who has any interest in Billy Joel or music or just the history of kind of what role he played in the history of music and music at that time.
Cool.
To check that one out. I know Steve is going to do it because he's...
I can tell.
He's older than me.
He's salivating. So. This does remind me, though, by the way, like I will say one fun takeaway for me is just hearing such really high quality hip hop again has got me inspired. And again, I have more on my plate than I've had in a long time, but I definitely want to get back into recording again. So
you got to get more agentic workflows so that you get all of your actual work out of your life and then you can focus on the creative stuff. It is creative.
Okay. It's very exciting. And you know a lot about it.
My playlist this morning started with Alice in Chains, which was a continuation from last night.
All right. I think I heard you last night, actually, as I was walking out of here.
You did. I passed you. In the spirit of Billy Joel, this morning I listened to Elton John. I'm more of an Elton John fan than Billy Joel. I lump them sort of together.
Yeah.
Reasonable.
They talk about that. They were a little bit confused, or people would try to tell him to be more like Elton, and he's like, "No, we're just really different."
Well, they're very different, but like kind of high level. And then, but then I was going on a run this morning with Matt Velez, and so I needed something more than Elton John to pump me up, so I switched.
I'm gonna guess.
No, you're not gonna get it.
Okay, fine. Go ahead.
Go ahead with the guess.
Yeah, I want to hear the guess.
I thought it was gonna be, you know, Ozzy Osbourne passed away.
Oh, that would
have
been. Oh, that's a good.
And so I thought I was gonna say Crazy Train.
Okay, that's good.
That'd be a good running song too.
That's a good run. That's a good guess. Okay, but it wasn't that
Metallica.
I would have guessed. Well, that's a good guess because I told you recently that's also a good guess. Another good guess would have been GNR. Actually, all those are better than what I actually listened to. But some Def Leppard. Still good. Still good. Got me pumped up. So then I went on this run with Matt. Matt and I are both pretty similar fitness level running. We weren't sure who was going to... We wanted to go on a run. Nice casual run, except there's a segment of the run called the Sand Ladder. Are you familiar with the Sand Ladder?
Oh, yeah. Down to the beach.
Yeah, off of... which beach?
Baker Beach.
Baker Beach, right.
It's part of the Escape from Alcatraz race course as well.
Yep.
It's not that big a hill, but it's really steep. It's super sandy and slippery. It's like uneven stairs. So it's like more obstacle coursey for those that are not familiar with it. Anyway, it's a good time trial. And, you know, it's on the order of a couple minutes. So it's not like some like half hour climb or something.
Yeah.
And I've recently run with other people at Presidio Bitcoin and people from my team and stuff. And so I knew, my PR up this is 1:54, right? So I figured running with Matt is going to really push me to PR. So we run it and we literally didn't know who was going to win, but it ends up, he did. He handily won.
Did he beat your PR?
He beat me by like 4 or 5 seconds probably. So it was like a very.
That doesn't sound that much.
Yeah, I mean, but it was a material. I mean, he had me there, like, because I was full gassed.
Yeah.
And he probably could have ran a couple of seconds faster. Anyway, so hats off to Matt for beating me.
Hats off, Matt.
Hats off.
I'm actually really happy though. So that's what you were surprised. Why am I happy?
Yeah, why are you happy? I've never seen you lose and be happy.
Because I checked out my PR and I beat it by 16 seconds.
What?
Oh.
Wow.
Which is huge. Right, like going from 154 to 138.
Helps have that rabbit there.
Enormous.
Wow. Iron sharpens iron.
And yeah. I it's not like I've been dogging it. Like yeah, 154, yeah. I pushed hard. So I like really, I wow. really pushed hard apparently.
Rocky.
Ran a 138. But love then, it. So I did really great. And
great. Matt did I'm glad you can celebrate your friends even when they kick your ass.
So the music, I always celebrate my friends.
That sounds like a challenge for DK. Is there a race being lined up here?
DK cannot run a 138.
I'm not ready for that.
But I also, actually, speaking of competitions, I've been doing more. I've not gone all in on pull-ups, but I've been doing pull-ups last, you know,
yeah,
a little bit on and off the last couple of years. I've moved beyond like off the couch doing like two, struggling to do two, and I can do like 12 or 13 pull-ups now, three sets of 10. That's sort of where I'm at. Pretty happy with that. But we have a pull-up bar here at Presidio Bitcoin,
right?
And I'm definitely not number one at Presidio Bitcoin because we you, me, and it was Andy, I think
Lawrence.
It was Lawrence.
Yeah.
Okay. We all tried to do our most, and I did 12. I think I got it at 13, but like I no more than 13. And then you did 15,
14 or 15.
15.
But I went first. I had more gas.
That's true.
I had more gas. Yeah, more gas.
Yeah. And then and Lawrence did more.
He did more. Yeah.
So
Lawrence pretty jacked.
And I think Austin.
And also,
well.
I was gonna say Austin seems.
So
like
I think we could have like some strong pull up. Competitions within Presidio Bitcoin.
Hey man, this is like the whole vibe of Presidio Bitcoin and everything. We're all pushing each other. Bitcoin, pull-ups, you name it. Like, get ready. There's going to be some big stuff coming out of here.
Yeah.
Yep.
August will too.
Yeah.
So let's see. What do we have on
Builders.
Store today?
I mean,
let's start with Builders.
Last night, Builders, right? Yeah. So I think the show, the concept of this event, I think was sort of invented on the show. I think you proposed it.
Yeah.
A month or two ago. And so last night was the official first one. And I think if anybody's been to...
Your guys' first one.
First one for us, DK. But
the second one that we posted.
It still counts even though we were there.
But it's, I think, inspired by the format of like a BitDevs or a LitDevs, but it's more for product builders. So it kind of approaches a new audience, welcomes a new type of builder in, somebody who maybe... has opinions and thoughts and ideas around products they want to build, but maybe isn't necessarily into the technical details of Bitcoin. You know, could be, but certainly not a requirement. So we sort of did a bunch of demos, which were mostly vibe-coded demos, which was really cool to see. We did a discussion section. We did some news section and kind of open-ended Socratic method style discussions, which I think the vibe worked really well to kind of get everybody involved. So I was a fan. I'll definitely be coming back to him.
Yeah. And to me, by far the coolest part was Matt. I guess he was here to run a race with Steve, but
also
kindly decided to do a little vibe coding in addition to that. It was, the demos were by far my favorite part. We had a couple demos. Matt's was my favorite because he was live vibe coding. And so, you know, I definitely still have not put in the time, like certainly DK and probably Steve at this point. So it was just really cool for me to see, you know, exactly what Matt's prompts were. You know, when stuff, because inevitably stuff kept failing, and it was like really valuable to see him like kind of bang his head against it and be like, all right, no, actually we're going to fix it. And here's how we fix it. Like, for example, it was like very interesting to me. So he's a REPL at Maxi, which is interesting. But within there, he made some very specific calls. Like he was using Lexi and their sidecar, I guess, API so that they could do Lightning payments with that. And he was like extremely prescriptive, like access the Lexi SDK at this address. He was like, download the binary, right, unzip it. It was like extremely precise. And I didn't realize you had to be that precise. That was pretty cool.
But I'd say
you don't have to be.
Yeah.
Oh, well,
part of what I would suggest, I don't know if it's right for the builder forum or just, you know, Matt and I were just talking about maybe doing live streams to try to help.
Yes.
1,000%. Help explain this stuff a little better.
I love it.
But Matt came to Builder with a lot of work done. He had pre-worked and had the thing working. And so he knew he'd sort of gone through a bunch of iterations and figured out how to do that.
Yeah.
And then he showed us, in a sense, it was like, it was just a prompt, but it was a prompt he had put a lot of effort into.
Right.
And he did that because we gave him a time constraint of 15 minutes, right?
Right, right.
And he couldn't have done truly zero to that in under 15. Although I think he did vibe code a simpler application literally for the first time in under 15 minutes.
Yeah.
This was more sophisticated. So I think there's just trade-offs there. Like if you, like you live streamed earlier this week and over an hour, and it was more opening up, like truly starting at zero.
Yeah,
and
like make their
unanticipated problems. And then, and that's definitely more educational, I think, but just takes more time.
Yeah. So. I mean, I think there's room for both. I love the idea of you and Matt and whoever else doing a lot more live streams. Like, I think that's the, like, we've talked about this in the show, like the single highest ROI thing that can be done for Bitcoin right now, probably, is just showing people how to vibe code with Bitcoin. But I would still love to see, even if it's simpler, to try at Builder a 0-to-1 demo. I think that'd be cool.
So yeah, I was thinking we should, at Builder, we should start with somebody. I'm happy to volunteer myself as a tribute, but start with like an empty notepad and kind of like improv comedy. Have somebody call out.
100%.
And have people kind of like, yeah, let's do that. How about if it does this? And kind of go through the process to show from like literally zero, not like a constructed prompt, no constructed anything, but just go from literally zero and walk through the process and be like, what about this? Oh, here's how I'll prompt it differently.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, to truly make it that way, someone from the audience could suggest, what do we want to build?
100%. Yeah, yeah.
And not have it planted, but improv, basically, right? But then have a skilled prompter driving it so that it goes kind of as fast as possible.
Yep.
But then everyone would really, I think, be inspired by that. Yeah, and see how it's done.
I could actually see this becoming like a pretty big niche in San Francisco, like replacing improv and improv comedy. Like, given the amount of vibe coders here, like
someone shared a tweet this morning saying, like, live streaming coding has been a thing, but it's for most people, it's pretty boring watching someone program a computer because it's just so tedious and takes so long to achieve. But vibe coding like is 10x or 100x accelerant.
Yes.
So that it gets within the realm of like possibly being entertaining.
Yeah.
Certainly it certainly is within the realm of like, if you're motivated to learn and be educated, then like it's good. And is it actually a new like esports?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I think Twitch or something maybe newer than Twitch should absolutely take advantage of this. And one cool thing, I mean, I don't know what the latest with Zapstream is. I know we still have to figure that out. By the way, shout out to our stand-up producer today, Ashu, who's helping. We're in the process of getting a Lightning wallet set up correctly for Noster. So don't worry, that is coming. We are going to make that happen. And I think our next step, which we've been talking about for a while, we're already on Fountain as well. So if you want to stream us those sweet, sweet Bitcoin, you can make that happen. A little plug. But we should do Zapstream. And Zapstream is like a live Noster-based client where people can watch you in video and stream you Bitcoin while they watch. I mean, to me, like all these people that are doing Noster stuff, like Alex Gleason with, I think, Shakespeare Now, which came out of Ditto. It's like a vibe coding set of libraries for Noster and Bitcoin. Albie's got their vibe coding platform. Like all of you guys should be doing this and doing it where people can stream you Bitcoin. And all of a sudden, who knows, maybe that catches lightning in a bottle because people are like, it's way more interesting to do it on these platforms where real money is being exchanged. And oh, by the way, did that money just 10x in value? That's kind of interesting. So,
I want to come back to, on a previous show, we've talked about vibe jamming where you have like multiple humans working together on vibe coding. And I think Replit has some feature for this. It's still on Matt shared with us, I think, DK, but I opened the tab and I haven't sadly engaged yet, but I want to play with that because I think that's a super interesting approach. And just from an entrepreneurial perspective, whether that's added, to Replit or other feature, or if it's a new startup, I think that could be in a whole new category of emerging growth. And then the one we just talked about, which is like live streaming.
Yeah.
And like maybe there's enough different here that like a startup could beat Twitch.
Yeah.
You know, if there's enough difference there. So I think for anyone wanting to start something and looking for ideas, I think that could be a really interesting category. Or just, expand it or like Replit should do it. Or Goose. So let's talk about Goose. It was,
But before we jump into that, because there's a lot I want to say, there's two quick things I want to note on that. One takeaway from last night that I guess whenever, I don't know if Alex owns the meetup or whoever does, one thing I think we should definitely do is a woman in the audience asked for an RFP tab. Because we have so many good ideas on the show and so many ideas that come out of the meetup itself where it's like, hey, wouldn't that be a dope product? Who wants to build Twitch for live stream or whatever? So I think that is a really good thing we should definitely sort of maintain for listeners of the pod, but also people that come to the meetup. And the second thing, and maybe we can talk about Goose first, but I do want to make sure we talk about what would it look like to have the multiplayer version control for vibe coding. I know Pablo was sort of playing with this on Noster, but I never really got exactly where that was going. But,
I actually think the Twitch idea may be, and I don't know, it could be a Twitch-like thing.
Yeah.
But there's something here. It's actually what one of the questions I left the group with was Matt did all this work, made a great prompt.
Yeah.
And then that prompt kind of disappeared into the ether. And so he then took the effort to publish it in a tweet today, which is much better than not.
Zero, yeah.
But then also that's going to disappear. So I almost feel like I wanted to encourage
creating a library of...
A library. And maybe that starts on a GitHub, a Presidio Bitcoin builder GitHub page that like any good prompt that gets demoed is available to anybody in the community who wants. And you can just pull it off there, just copy, paste into Replit or whatever you want.
Yeah.
Is at least a first step. But I could imagine that whether it's a live stream thing or something almost like, I've been kind of calling it like GitHub for prompts, mm-hmm. something, you know, GitHub is probably a fine enough GitHub for prompts, but there's probably stuff you could do even better that really make, you know, it's good for collaboration, but not necessarily very specific to prompting. You could imagine, maybe this is Goose, but I kind of want like something that's so open that my whole chat session just get published out to like somewhere that everybody can use, kind of like open source prompting and chatting. And then that, I think, unlocks a whole new data set that will make all of these open source tools, AI tools better.
And I think there's something like, there's so many cool ways you could play with this. So one of the first projects we got excited about with the Noster early on was, and I think you even contributed the domain name to this, Highlighter, highlighter.com, which is one of Pablo's many projects. And Pablo's the greatest mad scientist of all time. But Highlighter, I mean, what was cool about it was like, for those of you who remember, showing my age now, Rap Genius, like 15 years ago or something, you know, it was like got a lot of traction around, hey, how do we annotate, you know, hip hop lyrics? And then eventually the idea was, how do we annotate the web? And I remember Andreessen talked about, we didn't have an annotation layer for the web and it never really broke out of there. They tried to do poetry and stuff and you know, it's fine, but it never achieved its potential. We thought maybe early in the days of Noster, already escaped philosophy. It's fucking here, baby. And then it's like, well, we're at a plateau. There'll be another wave, but maybe something like this is, maybe the tectonic plates are shifting enough that there is an opportunity now. Because you can imagine you just spit out all of your open source stuff, and maybe there's a model that can help you sift through it and find what you want. But then imagine like with like the good prompts you like, you can like basically go and like highlight and zap and like resurface parts of the prompt that you love. So as an example, you know, in Matt's thing last night, maybe I highlighted and say, okay, you know, I don't want to build any of the actual product experiences that he's building, but I definitely want Lightning payments that work. Okay, I'm going to highlight, use the Lexi Sidecar SDK and unzip the file. I never in a trillion years would have thought to ask the bot to unzip the file. Okay, it makes sense. Yeah. So I highlight that. I'm like, boom, like zap it, you know, whatever. A lot of Bitcoin. This is something that everyone should use in their projects, and then you can start to surface it over time. So I think there's something, some mashup with the Noster open source highlighter ecosystem and this like vibe prompting library. Pablo, if you're listening, or if there are any other Noster superstars listening, this is, I think it's worth experimenting.
My experience with LLMs has me convinced that concept of highlighting that I'd explored for a while, Pablo explored, et cetera, is completely unnecessary because the tools should be able to figure out what is used, what is getting people success. Like if you have the data of like, I prompt and it fails. I prompt and it fails. I prompt and it succeeds. And I stop prompting along that path and I start prompting along other paths. That's actually signal to an LLM session that the thing worked. Or it's at least a candidate for what it would look like if the thing worked. If you look across hundreds or thousands of sessions, you can probably identify which prompts work and cause people to stop prompting in that direction. And then you can just use those ones for them. So you don't actually need a human to do it. You just need people to kind of grind through the examples.
So this is a really interesting point, and I generally agree. However, I think, I don't know exactly how this is going to play out, but my guess is there's going to be almost two categories of ranking data. There's going to be sort of implicit and explicit, and then there's a value, which this is the piece that I wrote back in 2022 before LLMs really popped off, before Noster popped off, called How to Disrupt Google. The idea was that information should be in marketplaces, like literally like just, you know, identity zaps information. That's like a signal to see where it ranks. My guess is it's going to be some combo of these things. Like 100% agree, LLMs get a lot of implicit data. Like, okay, this is what people are vibe coding with the most. Boom, like let's suck that into our library. But at the same time, I don't know exactly where it's going to go, but I think there's always going to be a rule, like a role for explicit human taste. And maybe the AIs like interact too. Maybe they're also zapping information. I know they can suck a lot of that taste in implicitly, but I think there's going to be some, like, I think it's going to go that direction super hard. And then there's going to be some kind of drawback to like, no, actually, we want the humans to like be more explicit in curating the data sets that the AIs use. I don't know where that balance is going to come though.
I think the more that you try vibe coding, the more that you'll be convinced that it's still human taste. I don't think the humans are going away anytime soon. But I think it's the human working with the computer, getting what you want, and then just moving on. And you get enough of that happening across enough libraries, examples, et cetera. I think the machine can figure that out. So I think I agree it's human. I just think it's not, it's human and it's taste. It's just the human decides what to work on. Their taste tells what to work on, but not explicit signals of like or highlight or whatever.
Think implicit just like takes everything.
Yeah, it's just too easy. Even like I was telling during Matt's demo, he was being very polite and saying, you know, here's a section where I think we have an error here. We should, investigate.
Just drop it there.
I screenshot it and just drop the thing and be like, figure it out.
Yeah, you don't even you don't even copy paste.
So we have we're anchored on these sort of like old ideas, like traditional ideas, but...
I would just like to say I potentially side with Matt on this one in that
we should try actually vibe coding and
I should
and you'll have more authority on this topic.
Yeah, he wants to get on the I know what he's going to say. He wants to get on the good side of the AI.
Absolutely, you guys are being assholes for our future overlords.
I for one welcome.
No. Like I mean, believe me, I say please and thank you, man. Like seriously, like I know this is going to be fucked up. But I remember that there was a kid in my high school, very quiet, kind of like creepy. I was always super polite to that guy if that day ever came. I know who's walking away, right? So I'm just saying, I would be nice to the AIs.
So if we could start, I didn't give my take on Builder, and since I'm the only one that went to Builder.
That's true. And since Steve actually did all the work for it.
And I did all the work.
Okay.
Just a few additional observations I had. We had 25 to 30 people. That's a great turnout. It's only our second one. It's the middle of summer. So really happy with the turnout. Like 7 or 8 women as well. And anyone who's been to like Bitcoin meetups, like there's very few women that show up. And so I was happy to see, quite a few women show up. Also, both the women, the newcomers to the space or to the meetup, everyone engaged.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody
was
active and participating.
Very broad engagement.
Yeah.
So I was happy that we created a welcoming environment that people felt comfortable sharing their opinion, sharing their view, adding an idea, asking a question. We saw that.
And having the microphones fly all around the room. Yeah, yeah. It's not a show. That's like
definitely what we're going for. Yeah. It's not supposed to be us just preaching to everyone. Yeah. So I thought that was excellent.
Yeah, great.
And throughout, whether it be the vibe coded demos, we had a startup showcase, and then we had various discussions throughout all that, just great audience engagement. That was great. I agree with you guys. The best part of last night was the vibe coded demos and the startup. We did 3 different vibe coded apps and then a startup showcase. That was, we budgeted like half an hour. We spent an hour on it, but it was a high quality hour.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Nobody was bored. Nobody's on their phone.
No,
so
it was great.
The discussion part, I think you guys may be a little disappointed with it. It wasn't as good as the first one, but having said that, there was still like good engagement on it.
Yeah.
I think that's a function of the quality of the topics, though. I think so. What we want to improve for next time is have more and better topics to choose from. And so, we'll all work together to do that.
I think it could also help if we kind of tee it up a little more. Like, I think, and this is not a neg on the process, but I think it was like, hey, here's a tweet. What do you guys think? Yeah. And I think if we instead said,
some context.
Here's a belief about the world, here's like, there's this pro and these cons, and like, are you pro or almost actually who is yes like do you know the I think is it the Oxford debate format? You know this Oxford debate format?
I heard it remind
where
me
you kind of take a position and you say everybody in the audience vote pro or con, so it has sort of segment yourself along these binary lines. You can't be in the middle somewhere. And then there's people who debate the topic, and then at the end you solicit, are you pro or con from the participants. And that's more of an audience style, but you solicit pro or con, and then the winner is the person who changed the most minds, not the person who has the most votes for their position.
Yeah,
that's cool. Hey, I like that idea, and we could also incorporate the lightning voting in there too. We could actually.
Yeah, that's one we didn't talk about. So one of the one of the Vibe Coded apps was one that came out of nowhere. Yeah. David, someone who
not this David.
Yeah, we had,
I'm DK.
We had three Davids last night, all engaging in great ways. So one of the Davids, he longtime traditional engineer, so you know he knows how to program a computer. And he loves the idea of Builder, so he volunteered to help out. And so he's helped out in various ways. But then the surprise way for me, like right before the meetup last night, he's like, "Hey, I vibe coded this app to add voting, and you can like send Bitcoin as part of your vote for the different topics." I'm like, "That sounds amazing." I'm like, "Let's try it out tonight and see how it goes." And actually, cool. Kind of unplanned, it worked out quite well. While people are eating pizza and chatting, you could like scan a QR code, go to this website, and then vote on topics. And we had over a dozen people engaged there. Or I mean, definitely we had some with 12 votes, so like at least 12 people engaged in that. It helped us rank the topic. So I think as we prepare topics for each week, we don't really need to care about the length or the number of topics. Yeah. Like put a lot there. As curators, we should make sure that they are all going to be like reasonable topics to discuss and valuable, but then let the participants vote and rank. That turned out really great. So that was a Vibe Coded app. Matt had his.
And on that app, by the way, we didn't get to talk about this. I was thinking about this when I was walking home at night, but I feel like that app is kind of the live participation thing of Builder. But to me, that feels like the hub around which all kinds of other useful software to empower our Builder community. I think the Miami Builder community happened last night too. And like Builder communities around the world as they sprout up to have like a piece of software that helps you run all aspects of the Builder. So like, let's say I have a topic that I want to submit for a month out. I should be able to do that today, submit it. And then whenever people want to look at it, whenever they register for the event, they can look at it and be like, "Oh, I'd like to see that. I don't really care about that, whatever."
Yeah.
I feel like this could be almost like I think we used Meetup for registration. Maybe we can make that all smooth and integrated because it's basically software is kind of free to develop these days, right?
Yeah. I agree. So there's definitely ways to integrate it better. We're gonna do that. You mentioned Builder Miami as well. And so we already mentioned on the show that there's gonna be a Builder. We already have like another location pop up, and we anticipate this will spring up all over the world. But it's exciting that there's already another Builder in the world in Miami. They had their first meetup last night, and they shared a summary with us, and it went super well. Yep. They had like 16 people attend, so good attendance, high quality folks there too. Like Joao showed up, and he's co-founder of OpenNode, and now he has a new startup. So like a very experienced Builder in the Bitcoin space. And Stephen DeLorme was there, and like Connor, and like so many great people were there. And it sounds like they had a similar experience to us in terms of like great audience engagement, and they vibe coded stuff as well.
Yeah,
it's great.
One other thought that came out of that, I really like your idea, DK, of having like a hub that can share software and potentially like topics and voting even across all of the builders. I mean, obviously, I loved that the voting mechanism last night came from the audience and like from someone local. That's really cool. But he was asking about ways to kind of like make it better and like should I prioritize votes more, or should I prioritize Bitcoin that's being zapped more?
And what's the formula there?
The formula there? And like, I mean, yes, we could have a lot of different takes on this. Maybe it's an Oster base, so it's more open, and I love that. But I do think that like maybe like the simplest and fastest way to get something like this off the ground, like more sophisticated wise, would be to do a Stacker News territory. This Kian's already got so much of that baked in the background, where you can have reputation, accrue value over time, and he's got like his somewhat complex like algorithms for figuring out how to decay votes and you know how you gain reputation. So perhaps that's another interesting thing to explore, be actually creating a Stacker News territory for Builder. And that's like one way we could surface what people want to talk about.
Yeah. So maybe it's like the topics go like global Builder is a territory on Stacker News. And that's more like the topics, the information that would be interesting to the Builder communities worldwide. I think the stuff that the other David did is almost, to me, it feels like it's more like an event management. Kind of live event pre-reg, event topics, maybe can pull from Global Builder, from Stacker News or something.
Yeah.
So to be explored.
Yeah.
Great. So we covered Builder really well, I think. One of the topics out of that, I want to talk about Goose, or you want to talk about Goose, I think. We'll talk about and then it's, so Goose is one of several different, front end software interfaces that you can engage different LLMs, right? Mm-hmm. And it's open source. And what was just recently announced as well is Block, who created Goose, has now created a new group that's very much like Spiral, the group I run, and that it's independent of commercial interest by Block. And they, I think they're starting off with 5 developers focused on Goose open source software development. So just a further commitment to open source Goose and have this independent group of engineers. And a grant program was announced similar to what Spiral has done for 6 years now. So I think that's super exciting. And, you know, I think there's interest by Goose to, like right now, Goose, I think, is optimized for like automating workflows, and whether you're at a corporation or if you're programming, like a lot of the vibe coding Jack has done has been done through Goose.
And just to clarify, in case people are unaware of Goose, you may be aware of like a Cursor or a Windsurf. Those are sort of closed source commercial IDE like things, you know, VS Code forks and stuff, or VS Code itself with plugins. But Goose is sort of, you know, in the same vein as that kind of thing, but a lot more just the chat and not really trying to kind of also present the code. So think of it as like an open source, very chat focused kind of competitor to the closed source Cursors and Windsurfs of the world, just to kind of set some context.
Yeah. And in general, I think, I mean, my own experience and talking like with you and a few other people, is that it's not as good of out-of-box experience relative to some of the commercial ones, but it is quite powerful. Like if you put in the effort, you can create really great stuff. So I think you know, the optimist view there is just it's just a matter of time. Like
because it's open, it'll probably be able to improve faster, and the hope is
it's open source, so it'll get and certainly Block's hope is that it's not just a Block thing.
It's
a public good.
Yeah.
Lots of other contributors. And so I am excited to see this new initiative that's Spiral-like, independent group, starting off with like 5 experienced engineers, but having this grant program as well.
So cool.
And do we have a Steve Lee equivalent? Do we know who it is?
There is a lead.
Okay, it's not announced yet.
I don't know if it's announced yet.
Okay.
But it's not a Steve Lee.
But
there is a lead.
interestingly, he worked at Google way back when we worked at Google.
Oh,
so early Google guy.
Google's having a comeback. All right. see your Twitter on that too.
Yeah. So I'm in touch with him and I'm like, hey, you know, I'm happy to give advice when, you know, anytime I can help out since I've been doing this for 6 years now at the company. So I think that's really exciting. And then one thing I talked to him about which we talked about.
Work here.
Yeah. Is like, you know, Presidio Bitcoin. Yes, it has Bitcoin in the title and it's Bitcoin, but as people know, first of all, in this show, we talk about AI a lot. We talk about the intersection of AI and Bitcoin.
We talk about open source and all the fucking time.
Open source.
Yeah.
And so, the hackathon we hosted here in May, AI was a big part of it in multiple ways. Using AI tools, vibe code, like half the participants vibe coded their apps and half of the top 4 were vibe coded apps. And then also, we talk a lot about AI, like agents using Bitcoin as payments. So there's so much intersection between those two topics. I think it's a natural home for people who want to work on open source AI, open source Goose, that they'd be welcome members here and like really have a rich environment to do their work, be around other open source advocates.
So cool.
Remember when I brought Adrian by here, he specifically wanted to come by to see what this felt like. Cause he was like, I kind of want to do an open source, you know, kind of an AI focused open source kind of workspace. It's not about startups, but it's more about helping support those kinds of contributors. So maybe this actually becomes
that
the kind of place that he was envisioning.
And especially, I mean, I hear through the grapevine there are more and more parts of the building opening up. So maybe the next move we just expand.
Is that right?
Yeah, well,
the yoga studio.
The yoga studio is safe. Don't worry.
Okay.
So the 5 full-time engineers on that team, I already checked. They don't live in the Bay Area, so I don't think they're going to be here.
Not yet.
But yeah, not yet. Well, the lead, I've definitely invited. I think he's going to come visit this fall.
Okay.
So then he'll see firsthand how great Presidio Bitcoin is. But for people listening, or if you know folks that would be interested in a grant to work on open source Goose,
so cool.
First of all, awesome. And then if you happen to be in the Bay Area or want to live in the Bay Area and you want to be, you know, it's a great space to work from with other awesome people, check out Pacific Bitcoin.
Can people just hop on like the GitHub and are there a set of lists or roadmap ideas of kind of what features or what big projects or topics Goose is about to undertake?
I believe so. I think they published like you know, like here's the top five priorities right now.
So I think it might be nice to be able to just sort of get a sense, not of just what the tool feels like, but also kind of where this is going to start to figure out if it's something.
I would also like to piggyback on that and just say that one of the things I'm increasingly bullish on is thinking about Noster as the agentic web. And so part of the reason I've been busy, a little alpha drop is, for LPs in the fund, you'll be getting the update later. It's finally done. Finally.
It took a long time.
Oh shit. I mean,
don't drop too much alpha here.
Not too much alpha, but
well, now it's when you give it to us.
I know exactly.
but setting you up.
One of the things that I'm increasingly sure of is that if Noster is going to win, I think it's going to be for something new. And I think agentic AI is the thing I'm most bullish on. And so obviously Jack is doing a lot of his like Noster vibe coding stuff with Goose as well. All of the like Noster guys that are vibe coding are using Goose. So I think that in addition to the intersection between sort of Bitcoin and Goose, I think people that want to use, you know, open identity and open data transfer on the web, tons of opportunity there with Noster. And a shout out to Gigi and Pablo. You know, they have their sovereign engineering cohort, which they run in Madeira. I think they're about to do number 5. It's awesome how many of these they've done. By the way, they have like a really, I forget the name of it now, but pretty out there podcast. I think it's like probably one of my top 3 favorite podcasts in the world right now. So shout out to, I think Gigi's been doing even more of that. Like,
what's incredible. The name of it?
I don't even remember, but
is it sovereign engineering or?
Somehow that's in the description or something, but okay. It's like, it's by pirates for pirates. So, it's good, but I would love to see us get a little bit of that sovereign engineering energy here at Presidio Bitcoin. So guys that are building and vibe coding with Noster, with Bitcoin and trying to build a free web. I'd love to see that.
And just to summarize some product roadmap ideas for Goose, we've talked about like prompt engineering and prompt skill development and prompt sharing and prompt education, all those things, like, and creating a library. Is that on Noster, GitHub, whatever? You know, maybe not. Maybe it's the data stored on Noster and it's integrated into Goose. Like it's just part of Goose. That's one thing that could be facilitated. We just talked about live streaming. Maybe that's like a separate project, but integrated into Goose in a seamless way, and awareness is created through Goose.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot. And then one thing I've talked to them a little bit about is privacy. Like I love what Maple AI is doing and Open Secret. Now with Goose, it's client side, and you can run a model on your computer too. So I mean, one way to get privacy is just run a model on your computer, run Goose on your computer, and then it's all local. But if you want to use a beefier or either, you know, if you don't want to set that up, if it's too much friction, or two, if you want to run a open source model that, is too beefy to run on your computer's not beefy enough, then,
not enough pull-ups.
I think you need like
not enough pull-ups.
Then, two of the ultra threes.
Then, you know, what's the privacy story there?
Yeah.
And it depends on the application. Like you're saying you want all your prompts to be open, like literally public, right?
Yeah.
So, obviously, for those use cases, privacy doesn't really, I mean, it's like literally the opposite of privacy.
Right.
But certainly for corporate stuff, for like health, like if any individual who's wanted to ask health questions, things like that, is going to be very privacy sensitive. Yep.
Okay, a couple thoughts that just came to mind with that. One, I was actually just chatting with Tony this morning without, again, dropping too much alpha. Shout out to those guys. They are like they went through a major pivot, and like I'm so proud of them, you know, Tony and Marks, but I mean, obviously Tony's been there for the whole ride. Like they're really getting product market fit right now. And it's so exciting to see like privacy. Like we always ask, oh, does anyone ever really care? Like the answer is yes. And like with every new Sam Altman interview that drops, like revenue goes to the roof. So just shout out to those guys.
Marketing tool.
It really is. Like, and so I'm super happy with that. So shout out to those guys. Number two, I do think, and I wonder if maybe there's some connection here between Presidio Bitcoin and Goose, where I still think one of the things we're missing, and maybe it's too early in the curve, maybe it's not commoditized enough yet, but I want to reiterate, I do not trust even the open source models until I can see the information it's trained on. I don't care about the weights. That's a great start. I want to see a fully open source model where I can go and audit and see, show me every piece of information that this was trained on.
And it would be nice to see an excluded list too.
Yes.
Like what was intentionally excluded.
I want to see everything in there because I am not at all yet convinced that if you don't have, like that the weights themselves, far better than nothing, but if you don't know exactly what it's trained on, I don't believe that we don't know what the risks
are. I mean, I agree, but like, how are you going to do that? Because it's too much information for human. So you'll have to use,
you'll have to use another
AI.
Yeah, exactly.
And then it's a little bit of a bootstrapping problem.
It is, but you can have multiple bots like checking this and be like, okay, well, if I don't necessarily totally trust this one, I have Claude running and I also have XAI. And like,
unless they're all colluding with
the rabbit hole runs deep here.
The big reset is all coordinated then.
Yeah. So. You heard it here first. But in all seriousness, I don't know what is the right approach to that, but this seems like, I mean, it's probably an extremely expensive project, but it seems like this is perhaps civilizationally, like I could just see, I mean, we're going to talk about the sort of like which way Western Anon turning point we're all at. Like there is a big turning point in the world. And this is one of the key cruxes in my mind. If you don't have that open model, like open source Goose is great. Open private model, great. But unless we see the data set, I think in 50 years, we're going to be like, oh shit, that was a mistake.
Speaking of the big reset, okay. It's a good transition to our next topic. I think you mentioned big reset kind of joking, but like,
Are we talking MicroStrategy?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes,
yeah.
We are. Yes, we're switching to strategy okay. And like their new offering, which I think you were the first that I heard observe that it maybe it's a stablecoin play, and then like you think
I believe
you,
I dropped that in the chat. Actually,
oh, was it you?
No, it was
you
me.
Did too.
I got it before you.
Okay.
Read well, this.
I think that's fair,
but I will say, shout out to Max. Like Max thinks Strategy might be like the most valuable company in the world
of all time, ever.
And then. So let's talk about that. Like, come on, that's crazy talk. Like, how could they become that? And then, is that good or bad for Bitcoin? Is that good or bad for the world? Like, does it lead to like, you know, economic collapse? And that's why you made the big reset comment. But like, does it set up now that Bitcoin is worth a whole lot more than in past bear markets, mm-hmm. and it's being integrated so much more deeply in the existing financial system. Mm-hmm. And we'll hear your story about how it gets, you know, 10x bigger,
far bigger,
50x bigger, 100x bigger, whatever. Then, you know, we're entering like too big to fail territory. And like, what if it's too big to fail, but it does fail and we have no recourse?
There's no bailout. Right?
That, you know, then the big, so.
Right.
Take
okay,
it
so I'll offer my perspective. And then on the stablecoin thing, I'm actually a little sort of less in the weeds. So I'd love to hear your take on that as well. But for me, you know, this has been a journey we've talked about on PBJ over the last several months. You know,
I think it was on our first episode, right?
Our very first episode.
But we huddled out there.
Yeah.
And I will say, I mean, I don't have a ton of MicroStrategy or anything like that. And obviously not financial advice, student research, blah, blah, blah. But like, I was forced buyer of MicroStrategy in my Roth IRA originally because Vanguard wouldn't let me buy the ETF. So thank you, Vanguard. And
forced. Interesting definition of forced.
Yeah, well, I probably would have bought IBIT or Bitwise or whatever.
So you could have bought NVIDIA.
If you understand what's happening in the world, that's a definite.
Not financial advice.
But anyway, so that kind of at least got me. And it's interesting because like I feel like with Bitcoin as well, like once you own a little bit, you're like, okay, well, now I want to read more. I'll start learning more. And it's been, I don't know, a year long or whatever. It's been now almost a year long journey to becoming both on my investment hat, a MicroStrategy maximalist, and on my like Bitcoiner hat, like terrified. So here's how I see things happening. What MicroStrategy has done is they have figured out that they're basically calling a bluff. And I think Danny said this really nicely in a tweet on the entire fiat financial system. They're basically saying, and you've said this too in many ways, that the entire fiat financial system is radically overpriced. NVIDIA is worth over like whatever, 30,000 Bitcoin or 30 million Bitcoin. There's not 30 million Bitcoin that will ever be in existence. Like MicroStrategy is calling the bluff that everything in fiat land is overpriced. Equities, real estate, debt, all of it. It's all overpriced. There is no way that any of these companies should be trading 50x earnings. It just doesn't make sense unless they're the store of value, right? And so MicroStrategy and Michael Saylor, who that man is a savant. He's going to go down as the Michael Jordan of finance. It's unbelievable as he's calling bluff and he's accelerating his own pace. What he's doing is, you know, everyone's debating, oh, well, should MicroStrategy be trading in MNAV or not? It's like, dude, that's just so the wrong question. That's missing the entire point. What Saylor is doing is he's a company and he's delivering value to the market. When you buy an equity, it's on, you're projecting in the future what the cash flows or what the balance sheet is a better way of saying. That in this new world of that company is going to look like, you know, years, decades into the future. And so forget, does MicroStrategy trading at a premium to MNAV? The better question is, what is the service that MicroStrategy is offering to the market? Well, the service it's offering to the market is it's taking Bitcoin, it's over-collateralizing that Bitcoin in a loan. So it's just literally saying, here's the Bitcoin as the base. Now we're going to go find product market fit for every pool of capital out there that exists that maybe wants some of this Bitcoin exposure, but because of, you know, the volatility of Bitcoin, because of mandates, because of regulations, whatever reasons, they can't buy Bitcoin directly. So we're going to offer them this product instead. And we've talked about that a lot on the show, right? Like, you know, first he did the convertible debt. Then he came out with these perpetual preferred equities that are targeting, you know, bond managers and portfolio managers that, you know, we know a lot of these guys that are orange pill, but they can't buy it any other way. Cool. And he's offering rates of return on all of these instruments, you know, and if you think about it, he's trying to go after different sort of risk appetites, different tranches in the stack, just like we've seen with, the classic, I don't know, CDOs and CDO squared and all this stuff from traditional finance. But the difference is it's not collateralized by homes that are like way overvalued, where they're giving loans for some, you know, someone in Miami to buy six homes, and they make $50,000 a year, which of course is going to collapse. Instead, he's like over leveraged this with like 7x or more the Bitcoin he needs. And in some cases, way more to make the minimum payments on all the offerings. So you can go deeper in the weeds. I highly recommend the punter Jeff dude. I've been like binging a lot of his podcasts. That guy is sharp AF, and he knows, I mean, like he'll spell it out in great detail. The big story this week, though, and the reason we're talking about this is so far he's been attacking, you know, the bond market. He's been attacking the equity market, $300 trillion and $100 trillion markets respectively. But I'm just starting to wrap my head around what happened this week, because this is the most gangster move I've ever seen in my entire life. Like, honestly, like, hats off to Saylor. I have to believe he's probably working with the state at this point for this to be allowed, but we'll find out. And what he's doing is now he's offering stable value with Stretch. And I was like, stable value? Fuck is that? And I start reading on this. I'm trying to understand. I'm listening to some of these podcasts, and it's finally started clicking. I'm like, oh man. So this instrument that he's offering, it pays out a monthly dividend, and there's an interest rate on that dividend, and the interest rate is adjustable. He's also got some other things. I don't fully understand all the mechanics, because I got the ability to call or claw some of this back when he wants to. So he has these different levers he can pull, but the idea is variable interest rate, monthly, paid out monthly, stable value. And you're just like, stable value? Huh? Wait a second. This guy's issuing a Bitcoin-backed dollar. Oh, shit. Because if he's at, and in his little chart where he explains this, he's like, and what are the markets we're going after? And he's like, all of commercial paper, all of like commercial savings accounts or like retail savings account, stable coins. I'm like, oh man, he's coming for Tether. He is coming for Tether. And then he's not stopping there.
Did he say that publicly?
Well, he didn't say it publicly, but in the slide, stable coins is like a tiny, tiny blip compared to the like, whatever, $7 trillion in like dollar denominated commercial paper and overnight lending. But when I started understanding this, I was like, okay. And one tweet from this Bitcoin research account I love just said it perfectly. Before this week, Saylor was, or MicroStrategy, whatever they're called, Bitcoin's investment bank. He gets Bitcoin, he goes to the market, he securitizes it, he brings capital into Bitcoin. Great. As of this week, assuming he's allowed to do this, and again, I am highly skeptical he's allowed to do this unless there's some implicit agreement from the state part. He is now the central bank. He is issuing effectively dollar-denominated assets, but unlike stablecoins, which with the Genius Act and all that can't offer the yield because Tether is making ungodly sums of money by just like blanketing all the 5% from treasuries or whatever it is, he's sharing yield with his customers. And unlike all of the past algorithmic stablecoins, and by the way, this has been like the wet dream of like all of the crypto bros, and Andreessen's back like six versions of this over the years. But they never work because it's always backed by some coin that people don't want. You know, it's always scammy people like, what's his name? The Korean dude. Like, it's always
Joe Kwon.
Yeah, that dude. It's like, but look, to be clear, like, I don't know, is there a chance that Saylor gets above his skis here and starts getting through? It's certainly possible. I'm not saying, like, this is the first one where I've been like, okay, watch this closely. But he has way more of a real asset backing it, which, in my opinion, is radically undervalued in Bitcoin. He has the ability to adjust interest rate, to take instruments out. I think that's what the sort of call option is, or clawback mechanism at any point. He's got a lot more levers that he can pull. And he's radically over-collateralized with how much Bitcoin he has. So if you start thinking about it, then he's like, okay, well, if he can start basically being the new issuer of the dollar, and now with the Genius Act, he can tokenize those instruments, which effectively become stable coins. Oh my God. Like, it's the story is not Tether. Story is not stablecoin. The story is, Michael Saylor is creating the new Federal Reserve. Now, and when I put on my investor hat, I'm like, as Bitcoin reprices the world, if you believe that's going to happen, I believe that's going to happen. We all believe that's going to happen. NVIDIA at 30 million Bitcoin is literally impossible. This is going to become the most valuable company in the history of humanity. Oh my God. And then you put on your Bitcoiner hat and you're like, wait a second, what does that mean for Bitcoin? Oh shit, this guy is going to like suck up so much Bitcoin. And, you know, I kind of joked that the attack was never sort of 1984, but Brave New World. It's not going to be like, okay, you can't hold your keys. No, it's going to be like, hey, like, just give us your keys. And like, you want that mansion and the Lambo? You got it, bro. It's all there. And a lot of people are going to be like, sweet, I'm in. And like, I mean, look, I'm an investor too. Like, you would be foolish not to at least entertain what's happening here. And yet, I also increasingly think that if we don't get some kind of a breakout use case for Bitcoin payments in the next 12, 18, maybe 24 months, like Bitcoin as money may not function for a generation. And that's a risk. I know that's spicy, but yeah.
Yep. And we're going to dive more into that risk in a little bit, but let's come. So one thing, so thanks for that explanation. do you see a next step, next logical step is to issue tokens that are one-to-one to this traditional security?
I don't think he needs to do that, because we saw, wasn't it Robinhood that says, we're going to take a thing, I don't even think they can't actually access OpenAI stock, but they said, we're going to tokenize AI stock and sell it to you.
You're saying he doesn't have to do it.
He doesn't even need to do it. He just...
Someone else will.
I would think about the spectrum of offerings that Saylor has provided to the market. You know, starting, the first one was MSTR, and that was just like all the volatility, no yield, right? So you get 100% volatility, 0% yield. Then Stride, Strike, Strife, I think, are the other three, right? They're just different.
I'm impressed.
Yeah, I'm impressed too. You've done your homework.
They're different, you know, areas on the, there's different trade-offs of like, you know, how much can you pull back? You can't claw back any of it. Here's the risk. You get a kicker in equity. So they're different spectrum of a little bit of risk, a little bit of vol, a little bit of yield, right? So there's some yield, some vol. And then this is kind of like the other end of the spectrum, which is zero vol, all yield, right? And so that is very, very similar to like stable or money market or U.S. Treasury. The U.S. Treasury is what, 4.5% or whatever it is. And I think these ones are 9%,
right? They're starting at
9. It's basically like double. But if the price were to get bid up, they would issue and drive it down, right? So he just is presenting this instrument to the market, and then Robinhood or whoever could take this publicly traded equity that they actually can get access to. They can't necessarily get access to OpenAI stock like they claim to, but they can definitely get access to STRC. They can buy that, tokenize it, and just make it available to everybody worldwide, right?
I see that, but let's talk about potential fragmentation and then what that would mean. So let's say Robinhood does that. But they'd acquire some of this security and then tokenize it, but that's just a subset of the total.
Mm-hmm.
And then other competitors might do that as well. But like Robinhood names this, you know, X, and someone else names it Y. Like there's a name mismatch, and then you get this fragmentation. Then we each have wallets, and we just want to have dollars in our wallet. Like what we care about is dollars in our wallet.
Yeah.
What actually is that? It's this token representation of this traditional security.
Right.
But mine is flavor A and yours is flavor B and yours is flavor C. So how do we, I mean, first of all, is that accurate that that could play out that way? And then secondly, how to deal with that fragmentation, interoperability, maybe the same playbook that stablecoin
issuance. I mean, that's what Bridge is, right? Yeah, Bridge is.
Exactly. And then my last question, doesn't that suggest that Strategy should be the central issuer of the token, much like Tether, and make sure that there's not interoperability issues?
Yeah, I mean, I think those are great questions. I don't think we have tons of clarity on any of them, but none of them seem like, it seemed like the kinds of things that would play out in the market, and they could.
These are not posed as like, oh, this future is not going to work out. It's more just like, we will stumble across.
My guess is it will be better for Strategy, and I don't have any inside information on this, but my guess is it would be better for Strategy to just say, here's a thing in the market, go do stuff with it.
Free market, go.
And, you know, if Robinhood wants to make their own fine, and if Schwab or somebody wants to make their own fine, somebody might, there might be a startup opportunity to be like what Bridge did for stablecoins, to do that for tokenized equity.
Yep.
Right. So that wouldn't surprise me if that kind of thing were to emerge. And if that were to emerge and there was tons of volume, but ultimately it was all STRC as the stablecoin, maybe Strategy would later come in and say, okay, let's clean this up.
And to be clear, I mean, markets, even prior to Bridge, priced this stuff, right? Like in the early days of stablecoins, or like at least in the last DeFi wave in 2020, you had the algorithmic stablecoins, like MakerDAO, of course, that's backed by ETH. Like, and then you've got, the USDT and USDC, and those traded at different prices relative to each other based on people's different confidence, liquidity, things like that. So I think the market will probably solve that problem. Maybe it's interesting for him to issue his own. Like, I don't know. I mean, at this point, I'm like, Saylor can see into the future further than I can. What I do think about, though, is, I mean, the banks have got to be like kind of furious about this, right? Because they just fought to be able to keep the ability to issue stable coins and keep all of that sweet. And Tether's got to be furious. Like the treasury yield themselves, like this is kind of like a checkmate move on both the banks and Tether, which is why I'm kind of like, you know.
And Circle.
And
Circle just IPO'd and the valuation was expected to be $5 billion and now it's what, $60 billion or whatever. So getting to the, so first of all, what, you know, it impacts them as well.
Yeah.
Also, as far as like Strategy valuation, if you just look at the valuation being applied to a Circle and whatever Tether is valued at, which would be, has to be much more than Circle. Yeah. It does kind of suggest a huge valuation.
I think the STRC IPO was meant to issue 500. Is that right? 500?
Something like that. Million.
Million.
I don't know.
I think I saw that it's at 2.8. billion?
2.5, 2.8.
I thought I saw 2.5 and I saw there's another one that said 2.8. So maybe as of this morning,
it's radically oversubscribed.
Did it price yet? Is it out today or no?
I just saw people speculating.
So. A couple months ago, someone we all know and respect, I think I wasn't part of this conversation, but told you guys that Tethertron, like, it's one.
Yeah. He's like, stop LARPing. 100% Silicon Valley VC.
Like, yeah. USDC is a joke. Yeah, yeah. All the other platforms are a joke. And I forget if we talked about it on the show or just privately, but I'm like, I totally disagree on the underlying platform. Tether's already demonstrated you can like switch those out over time. And then Tether itself, obviously they are in the driver's seat right now. But I think there's going to be stiff competition with the Genius Act. There's going to be more competition. I mean, the Genius Act, we didn't talk about it on the show yet, but like, there's a framework so that you can have federal issued and or even state issued ones, and there's like a cap. A state issued one can only be up to $10 billion, but that framework creates a structure where you can imagine lots of competition, lots of different stablecoin issuance. So anyway, with that backdrop, now we're talking about Strategy, maybe checkmate move. First of all, that to the degree that that's true or becomes true, then Tether's very vulnerable.
Extremely. And let's be clear on this, right? The reason I'm saying it's a checkmate move is because they have so much more Bitcoin than anyone else in the market that they're, and remember all of these different instruments, it's all a flywheel that allows them to just keep sucking the Bitcoin out of the market.
Yeah.
And so it's reflexive. Like the more people buy each of these instruments, including the like radically oversubscribed dollar instrument they're issuing, the more Bitcoin they get. So like, I don't think there is any entity that can play catch up with them at this point, other than perhaps the US federal government itself. But again, I kind of have to think that they're okay with this. Otherwise, and it's almost like a checkmate move from the Fed against the banks, because the banks, I mean, like what's going to happen is if you're Tether, they have a lot of Bitcoin, and maybe Tether is the one entity that has like a Hail Mary they could throw to, you know, to try and catch up. And that's probably what they're doing in 21.
Yeah.
But the issue is like Saylor's so much more Bitcoin than you do. So unless somehow, and I'm guessing we're seeing all these OG whales moving lots of Bitcoin. I think one report was that Adam Back was moving it into 21 or something. So maybe they're just like behind the scenes trying to just gather as much Bitcoin as they can to try and catch up. But like, as they start doing that, the genius of what Saylor is doing is it drives the value of his Bitcoin up even faster, which makes it even harder to catch him. And by the way, all these other treasury companies that we've talked about, like, I think he's just goading all these people into doing this. No offense to these people, but like, I'm sorry, there's no way you're better at risk management than Saylor.
And you're not going
to
get the same credit terms. Like,
I have a great meme. This one of us has to. So you know the meme where like there's someone sitting behind someone, they have a gun to their head, and then someone behind. It'd be like we're all facing not each other. And,
oh yeah, the, but then the there's astronauts actually, in Earth.
No, not the astronaut. Oh. They're like in astronaut. They're in like a courtroom or church or kind of pew like seating, and then like. So it'd be like
we need the meme generator. By the way,
you know what I'm talking about, or not? Because there's three people sitting, right in a row.
Okay,
not facing each other.
Yeah.
Okay.
And like, so imagine you guys turning around. You have a gun to his head.
Yeah.
You think you've got him.
Yeah.
I've got a gun to your head. And but then there's a fourth person way up high who has the rifle shot or whatever. And they're
I've seen the one with the guy with the bubble. It's the same concept, right? The guy with the bubble, and then you zoom out, and then it's like the guy who's holding the guy. Yeah.
So, seriously, we need a meme.
I thought it was better at memes. I don't know this one.
Bitcoin. I've asked for this like 6 months ago. Please, someone build this so we can collect those sweet sats. Bitcoin.
Now I forgot.
Thank you, Asher.
Thank you.
Oh,
there it is. Okay. Thank you.
Person of interest, church sniper.
But they don't show the sniper.
The last one.
Or meme generator.
Yeah,
I see it in the bottom. Yeah.
Oh, you can kind of see the sniper in the bottom right.
It's poor resolution. Okay. Yes, I've seen it. Okay, sorry.
But now I'm forgetting who the sniper is. Oh my God.
It's the U.S. government.
Sailor, Elon,
but not
Paulo.
Not like. Okay. Oh my God. It'll come to me, but we can move on. I had some brilliant like sniper that's not strategy.
Oh, somebody that we haven't talked about.
Yes.
Okay.
It's going to have to come. To
well, this I know. You can't give us the clipping.
Well, while you think about it, I'll give you some time to think about it.
Austin knows your meme. By the way, we have some chat. We should chat on, but yeah.
Oh, thank you, Austin.
Yeah. Thanks, Austin. Awesome. He's a diehard PBJ fan.
Oh, we do have. Scroll up on that? Is that possible? In the chat? There's not much to scroll up.
Famify
Oh, Famify is back. Thank God.
That was being a courteous Canadian.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Is that friends? I was going to say is you mentioned that maybe Adam Back and people are moving. I'm certainly not in his position, but I did hear about
2011 OG.
I did hear about private transactions that are offering Bitcoiners allocation in private treasury company transactions if they move Bitcoin into them. So
I think Strive, which is Vivek Ramaswamy's, I think that's kind of the way they're trying to differentiate, which again is. And I hate to say this, this is why, like the stuff you said, it's so important that you get the, it's not Hotel California, you get the ability to withdraw in kind. Cause what they're doing is they're saying, hey, Bitcoiners, it's the same thing I'm saying. They're saying, give us your keys and don't worry about it. You know, Malibu, or I guess Malibu's gone, but like, I don't know, somewhere nice with the mansion. Like, I don't know, man.
I remembered my ultimate checkbook.
Yes.
I mean, it's kind of a joke, though, but Satoshi is the one.
Oh, yeah.
Because who has more Bitcoin than MicroStrategy? Satoshi.
Yeah, sure.
Yep.
Sure.
Mm-mm. So it's a long conflict, or a long play.
Yeah.
And I think as Bitcoiners who appreciate the benefits of self-custody, I think we could look at this and be like, this is crazy. This is stupid. Why are we letting them do this? This is XRP. And I would actually take the view that it does have that feel to it, but I think it's impossible for Bitcoin to become a mainstream thing without the TradFi or TardFi, as some people say, kind of ecosystem.
I've never heard that.
I haven't either.
Oh, I have a friend who always uses that.
The things you learn on DBJ.
TardFi.
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 Sorry, I guess TardFi works too.
Is that even, that's not politically correct.
Probably not.
Nah. You might be, we just got
canceled.
The show canceled.
Okay, good.
After the Sydney Sweeney drop, politically correct's over.
All right.
We're back to normal.
But I don't think we can, you know, I don't think Bitcoin can get to the whole world without this kind of unfortunate style of, you know, integration with the traditional financial system, because it's what people are comfortable with, and people are not going to change what they're comfortable with as fast as they're going to understand that they should own some sort of Bitcoin, you know, own.
At the President Bitcoin launch party, we were fortunate enough to have Jack Dorsey here, David Marcus here, Michael Saylor here. So three prominent people within Bitcoin with pretty different view or like things that they emphasize around Bitcoin. And I listen to all of them, and I agree with all of them.
Same.
In my view, they're not competing visions.
Right.
They're just, they're emphasizing different. I mean, Bitcoin is such a complicated beast. They're just emphasizing different things. Jack emphasizes, you know, freedom tech and freedom money, you know, I would call it like Satoshi's vision, the white paper, the peer-to-peer cash.
BSC.
Careful with that.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to let them steal. Yeah.
Like, we're taking it back.
Yeah. Taking it back. Vision, yeah. So, and David Marcus emphasizes like using it as money, everyday money. And Jack definitely does as well. I mean, he coined everyday money within Block, and I think other people are starting using it now. Whereas Saylor, like, that's not what he emphasizes. Yeah. And it's capital, and it's everything you guys just talked about. Right. And also, I mean, I'm saying this because of what you said, David. I mean, you can love or hate adoption by financial institutions, institutional money, governments, whether it be at the local, state, country level. You can love or hate that. But first of all, I mean, no one should really be against it in principle, because Bitcoin's for it's permissionless. Yeah,
it's for everyone.
It's for everyone. So now it's certainly reasonable to like monitor the situation and be like, it's becoming an unhealthy balance. And we're gonna talk about it right now on the show about risk to Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. So that's absolutely worth discussing. And like, okay, but it's less about like, okay, we need to change the code to like prevent a bank from owning it. It's more like, what are the incentive structures, or how do we accelerate using Bitcoin as everyday money? So that there's competition for these different use cases, and we can protect and preserve some of the key properties of Bitcoin that might be lost over time if the dominant narrative and actual usage of Bitcoin is number go up and it just gets sucked into treasury companies and ETFs.
So I want to offer two thoughts on this. One is a response to what you said, and then a response to what you said. I, again, putting on my investor hat, MSTR, holy shit. Honestly, like tip of the hat to Saylor. I put on my Bitcoiner, or like kind of like hoping this actually promotes human freedom hat. I'm like, we might be in some problems. We might be in for some problems here. Now, just to play back on that a little bit, I had a really great chat with Ben Ark. And Ben is one of my favorite people in Bitcoin, because, you know, he's much more of the like, Bitcoin is not, you know, purely capitalism. In fact, he used to call himself BT Socialist, which is kind of funny, but it's something new. It's a commons. And for those of you who don't know, Ben is effectively the co-founder of Nostr with Fiat Jaff as well, who also helped him start Ellen Bits. And anyways, very, very interesting guy. I did a pod with him about a year ago. Highly recommend listening to that. Like, we talk a lot about sort of dialectics and sort of like, he's a big Hegel fan. And the thing I asked him when we chatted on Wednesday or Thursday is, I was like, Ben, like, make me not depressed. Like, if it really is, like, sure, we all get rich, but like the whole mission dies. Like, and he was like, yeah, don't worry about it, man. And because he's like, this is just how reality works. Dialectics. There's a thesis, an antithesis, and then a synthesis, right? And so like, I increasingly think this is the way it has to go. Like, to your point, like, there's a new freedom money, but there's still all the old capital that's sitting out in the old world. And his point was like, Bitcoin is going to reflect some of this in its image. And then this is going to reflect some of its in its image, and it's just going to keep going back and forth until we reach the new stability point. And so I think that, I mean, it's kind of this question of like, is Bitcoin corrupting is Bitcoin fixing the traditional financial system? Is the traditional financial system corrupting Bitcoin? The answer is both, and it's going to keep going back and forth for a long time. Then the question I come back with, so in that sense, and by the way, even if it gets totally quote unquote captured, I still think it's at most for a generation. Bitcoin will break free. People will always remember, oh yeah, there's that reason we didn't do the same mistake we made as civilization for like every 100 years, for 1,000 years or 2,000 years, whatever it's been.
At that point, there's only going to be like a million Bitcoin left over that are not lost by these other.
No. But at some point,
what do you mean? You can steal them, right?
Yeah, it'll be stolen, or Saylor, like his predecessor won't be, or his successor won't be anywhere near as competent as he is. They'll puke the coins out. Like, eventually nature will solve this problem. Then the question I have, though, is like, and this is
I'm saying Bitcoin is going to be more scarce than people realize. There's not 21 million, there's a million.
Maybe, but
in the future.
Debatable with quantum computers and all that, but regardless, like,
but yeah, they can be so. I mean, unless you're saying they're going to permanently burn them,
yeah, you know, get lost, get hacked. You know what happened if Coinbase
but
got hacked?
But
that's a real one.
But sure, but they're not. Then they get recirculated.
They'll get recirculated eventually,
just like with quantum computers, recirculated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I mean, it might be. Yeah.
So okay. So yes, but I agree with Steve on like eventually get recirculated, but. Then the question I have is a question that we've been discussing in sort of the Kevin Kelly context for years, which is, you know, Kevin Kelly has this wonderful book called What Technology Wants. And the fundamental question that I go back and forth this, I don't know the answer, is like, is everything scripted, or is there free will? Is there the ability to shift things a bit? And sort of his argument has always been that technology has to follow a certain pattern, like water flowing down a river. There's a reason that we see fractal patterns emerge everywhere. Like that's just how nature works. So he would argue that once you have different technological blocks that come together, there's an inevitable form, almost a platonic form of the next technological block. And Bitcoin, some version of Bitcoin was inevitable. And I agree with him that there are things that are inevitable. However, he also pushes, and this is the part I don't know, I hope he's right, we'll find out, that the character of that next building block can in fact be influenced. And so the argument would be, as an example, some form of digital communication system for the whole globe, inevitable. Digital money for the whole world, inevitable. A hive mind, which is what I call my fund for a reason that we're all growing into, inevitable. But the character of that hive mind could be China top down, or it could be Bitcoin bottoms up. And so the argument is like, you know, can you, with leverage of whatever sense you want, tip the scales towards the bottoms up versus the top down? I don't know the answer to that. I certainly hope you can. That's, I think, why we're all spending all of our time and energy. We're making a bet that you can do that, and we'll find out. If that's the case, my sort of thesis, and I posted a few tweets about this week, is I think we got 12 to 18 months, 24 max, before all the Bitcoin or like so much gets siphoned off that we're in serious trouble, to try and find breakout velocity for payments. Now, I love what Block is doing, and we should talk more about using Bitcoin as everyday money. My strong intuition is that it's going to take too long to get people paying, you know, at Square. It's great they're doing it. We should be pushing on every front. My intuition is, if you're going to get breakout velocity before capture happens, and by the way, I'm not even saying Taylor wants this in a bad way, before the inevitable consequence of gravity plays its course, even if he's a totally good actor, which he very well may be, is that you have to find something with the J curve potential. It needs to be something that could literally just go exponential, which is why we had the Bitcoin AI hackathon, why we were pushing so much on getting Goose in here, why we're talking about payments for agents. And increasingly, I'm of the mindset that we need something with probably AI that could just go vertical. Then you get into the debate about what could that be. I've talked about my ideas from the Edge podcast with Dhruv. If you haven't listened to that, there's a lot of ideas in there. But the two ideas that I came up with the most that can move the needle, somewhat provocative, but somewhat real. One, on the off chance that Andre Karpathy listens to this podcast, you should absolutely, I love XAI, but you should absolutely join Block, work with Jack on Goose, like try and get this thing adopted. Like, this is a chance to save freedom. Like, so that's one move I could see making. The other is Cloudflare. They're in a tremendous position to influence the way the internet goes. If they were to adopt L402 instead of like some centralized thing for the way agents are paying each other, that could be a massive, massive move. But these are just two ideas that come to mind. But my point is, I think we have a very limited window to tip the scale, and it can't just be, it needs to be something big.
Let's expand on that. So yeah, if, let's say the next 2 years, Bitcoin payments don't become everyday money, don't explode,
yeah,
which I'd say is the default base case, that, you know, despite we're all working on it, a lot of people are, but that's the base case. What, in 2 years, why is it inevitable then that it won't happen after that point?
Well, I mean, my fear is that enough people will either have like turned over their keys in terms of like they want to just do some kind of in-kind redemption into Strategy or one of these treasury companies because they realize they're going to get better returns that way. And so they're willing to sacrifice that, or enough somehow gets centralized that, well, I mean, one of two things. Either there's the 1984 approach where somehow it becomes harder to hold keys, but like you're given tax benefits or like various, like, I don't know, slaps to hold an ETFs or MicroStrategy instead. Or the narrative just gets so far pushed that no one is even like even thinking about that. Like, they're already adopting the centralized versions, which we'll talk about. Maybe that even comes through kind of like, I don't know, the stable coins or like other centralized providers that get enough adoption, while Bitcoin is just getting so heavily sucked into the centralized ecosystem that not enough people are experimenting. To be clear, I'm not saying it's like 100% checkmate, right? Like, maybe there is still time, but it just seems like the forces of gravity are Bitcoin gets sucked into more centralized providers, more people get either sticks or carrots to hand over their keys. And at the same time, centralized solutions start getting breakout velocity, and it's like people are doing micropayments with dollars.
So I think to just elaborate on that or expand on that, I don't think it's exactly people who hold their keys. It's people, there's a set of people who have the option to do it.
Yeah.
So there's obviously a segment of people who manage their own private keys. There's a segment of people who hold their coins on exchanges like Coinbase. And if we're looking at percentage of people, number of people, a lot more people hold it on exchanges than self-custody. If we're looking at amount of Bitcoin, then
yeah,
the majority is self-custody still, but number of people, it's
yeah.
But at least, you know, if you hold it on Coinbase or Cash App or whatever, you can withdraw you have that option. And it generally works.
Yep.
Well, sometimes people run into hiccups, but
Cash App needs generally
Coinbase too. I mean, like, you are beholden to like policies and like whatever. I think the dangerous part is if your Bitcoin is an IOU, and it's, you can't withdraw it. And that's the case right now with ETFs. It's also the case if you buy Strategy.
Yeah.
Or any of these Bitcoin treasury companies. And it ultimately becomes the tax trap.
Yes.
Because the tax trap is like, I have, you know, let's say I have $10,000 and I make an investment and I buy an, you know, BlackRock's ETF or Strategy, doesn't really matter, either one. And then it moons. It goes to $50,000, $100,000. And now I have huge capital gain. But now I've reached a point in my life, I actually want some Bitcoin to use as everyday money. That, like, all of a sudden that's become valuable to me. Well, I can't do that with these products, at least today's versions of those products. And I'm hesitant to, like, I can't withdraw. Bless you. So I'm in a tax trap.
Yeah.
Because I have to take this massive haircut to sell it, to turn it into actual Bitcoin that I can use.
Right.
And then it creates significant friction. If I have to pay 30, 40, 50% tax and lose that much of my Bitcoin just to spend it. So that, I think that's the huge
risk. Is not here today, but this in-kind redemptions, I think it was, you keep reminding me that it was, I think,
proposed
in January for authorized participants, so like the Jane Streets of the world, for more efficiency. And it's not yet been proposed to make it to retail. But if you had in-kind creates and redemptions to and from retail, wouldn't that avoid the tax trap on ETFs? Yeah. But
yes, but not yes.
But MicroStrategy, but you're, not never gonna, you're never going to like redeem.
So something everyone should be, people who care about the health of Bitcoin long-term. And this is not just, I mean, there's a segment of people, a large segment of people in Bitcoin that only care about store value, number go up. They either believe that it'll never become everyday money, they don't even care if it does, or they think it's like 50 years from now. I'm not judging. I'm just saying there's a large segment of people that are in that camp. There's obviously a camp of people who like work towards this or want it to be that, or believe that's the entire purpose of Bitcoin.
Right.
The point of me saying that is that long term, if Bitcoin loses its core principles, then everyone will lose.
Yes.
And that's one of the things I'd like to...
message doesn't get out enough.
It doesn't get out enough. And I don't think most of the people in the camp of number go up, store of value, don't care about everyday money, don't realize that their investment long-term becomes, it's a LARP.
Like,
David and I talked about this when we were mountain biking the other day, that over the weekend, that ultimately, like, to me, Bitcoin just becomes like XRP or something.
It's a spicy take.
Yeah, because there's a million different tokens.
Right.
So there's a reason why we are diehard Bitcoiners and a lot of other people are diehard Bitcoiners. If you've done enough education, enough work, you understand the distinction and what makes Bitcoin different than all the other tokens.
Thermodynamics.
And then when you compare different, you know, compared to like Ethereum, it's a little bit more interesting debate because Ethereum has a lot of positives to it. But you know, we can certainly lay out why Bitcoin is very highly differentiated to Ethereum and why it stands to win in the end. But against something like XRP, like something that's like extremely has all kinds of like crazy pre-mined token issues and centralized.
I'm watching the chat now.
the army.
The XRP army.
Please no, God no.
I think we need to tweet it.
Oh, good.
Tweet it out to get attraction, but we don't need to do that.
Don't do that, Ashu,
please. So.
We should scroll and see what else people are saying.
But if Bitcoin loses core properties such as like ability, like realistic ability to self-custody, decentralization, privacy, it's not perfect privacy, but the privacy it has, censorship resistance, if it loses those properties, then it's sort of like, okay, it's kind of just another token.
Yeah.
And I use XRP as an example, but it's just another token. So it's no longer like why is it distinct? Why does it deserve this multi-trillion dollar valuation compared to thousands or millions of other coins. We can create meme coins or whatever. So I think that everyone, including the people who are in it for the investment, need to care about this. So important things to monitor, and everyone, including big money, needs to advocate for is in-kind redemptions, and not in-kind redemptions just for institutional investors, but in-kind redemptions for everyone. And so if we got that, then that, you know, that basically addresses that risk with ETFs. But then we're talking about the Bitcoin treasury companies and, you know, millions of Bitcoin being sucked into those. If they don't have an in-kind redemption, then that's the same tax trap risk. And I see it as less clear to me. What's the motive? First of all, what's the motivation for Strategy to offer that? Because they have all these complicated financial engineering mechanisms, and it's very important to them to have maximizing Bitcoin AUM or the number.
I don't think they would ever have.
So I don't see the motivation for they would. So I don't think they would. So to me, that is like the pinpointing of the threat that Bitcoin treasury company Strategy is the leader there, sucking up all this Bitcoin, no ability for any shareholder to access that Bitcoin. It's a tax trap that creates enough economic friction so that those people never use it.
It's
everyday money.
Yeah, that's correct.
And then, okay. And then another part of this concern is that, you know, anyone who monitors the mempool of Bitcoin, like the Bitcoin network, how active, how many transactions are there trying to be transacted on the Bitcoin network, which is distinct from the price or how many people own Bitcoin or even use Bitcoin. Because if you use Bitcoin and it's purely on a custodial platform and never has to touch the Bitcoin network, well, then there's no activity in the Bitcoin network. So if you monitor the Bitcoin network and the mempool, for people not familiar with that, is just simply the queue of transactions that have been broadcasted globally that want to get transacted and ultimately mined. That has historically been, first of all, the fee markets, the fees you have to pay for a transaction have historically been quite low. Most of the money made by miners is through the Coinbase reward, the subsidy, the minting of new Bitcoin. As we know, that goes to zero. So for Bitcoin to thrive long-term, there has to be a thriving fee market. There needs to be strong demand to broadcast transactions and enough so that people are competing to get into the next block and pay a lot of money. Otherwise, there'll be no economic incentive for miners and the entire security model gets destroyed.
Here's a spicy question. I'm just curious, but like, doesn't Lightning kind of limit the need to have transactions through the mempool?
Yeah. Yes and no. So... yes, it's true that like if we open a Lightning channel, you and I can transact infinitely back and forth and never touch the chain again. We only had one on-chain transaction. But on the flip side, anyone who studied Lightning, another criticism is it doesn't scale because it takes up too much block space.
Mm-hmm.
And you constantly rebalance the channels if you need to reopen or close.
Like Lightning, as it's currently, the protocol is currently constructed, can't be used by the world. Because if 8 billion people use Lightning channels, there's not enough block space to open those Lightning channels. So it actually would overwhelm demand for block space. So while it does create this efficiency layer, if Bitcoin payments take off, it creates on-chain demand.
But Lightning, there's a lot of Lightning transactions. My understanding is that from any kind of triangulation you can make on Lightning, it's growing quite well. It's small, but growing. And so my understanding is like the mempool and Bitcoin block transactions are not.
I think the explanation is clear there. So there, it's still tiny, right? So, and it's not enough to dent into I think a reduction in demand for block space is introduction to ETFs. So there's a shift of incoming capital is going to ETFs, which don't hit the chain at all.
Mm-hmm.
And people are doing less like buying on Coinbase, moving those coins to Kraken to like buy some other coins or trade or whatever, or move it to self-custody or whatever. There's less of that. There's more ETF buying. So that reduced demand dramatically. And the Lightning growth pales in comparison to that reduction, despite the growth of Lightning payments. So if that continues to grow at the rate it's growing, absolutely it will increase the demand for block space. And that then, great, problem solved. Whether it's Lightning, Arc, Spark, there's all kinds of different technologies that facilitate payments, but it just requires a much bigger payment growth than the tiny, tiny market we have.
And to be clear, I mean, I definitely think it is part of it, right? I agree ETFs are probably a much bigger part. Like, yes, like short term, it sucks some volume off the chain, but my guess is that a lot of the stuff that's happening at Lightning is net new. Like for example, the Zaps on Noster, I imagine just would not happen if there was another network. Yeah. And also like a lot of these guys, like again, they're constantly opening and closing channels and rebalancing things too. So like there's still a decent amount of on-chain activity that exists today that is probably
doing that. Let's take that example though. Yeah. Like Noster, Zaps, Stacker News, Zaps, they don't impact the on-chain like hardly at all.
Right.
Because the predominant amount, the vast majority of the Zaps are from custodial wallets. And those custodial wallets just have a few Lightning channels. So they've just done a few on-chain transactions, tiny, and yet there can be like millions of Zaps.
Right.
So the footprint on-chain is very tiny there. but again, if we see hyper growth of Bitcoin payments on any kind of, and as long as those payments are done, there's a sufficient amount of like inter-system payments.
Right.
So it's not just one company's effectively custodial system.
Right.
As long as there's enough interplay there, then we will see a material footprint on chain. And then the Bitcoin network is healthy. There'll be a healthy fee market. It all works out. But the long-term risk here is that so much Bitcoin gets sucked into like Strategy and Bitcoin treasury companies. And number one, either Bitcoin's everyday money never takes off. And then the Bitcoin network just has no activity. And literally, we'll get to a point, I mean, there's already people calling for like creating tail emission. Like there's a concern that like miners aren't going to have an incentive to mine once the minting of Bitcoin trends towards zero. Even at the Quantum Bitcoin event, there was one person saying that in 8 years, if we don't see growth of Bitcoin payments or something that creates sustainable demand for the network, that we're going to have to introduce tail emission. I think it's more of a 15 to 20 year time frame where it starts to get concerning, not 8 years. But either way, that narrative will only grow louder.
So you're saying the degens are our only hope?
Well, that's I don't know if it's sustainable. Sustainable mempool or block space demand. So the concern is that whether it's 8 years or 15 or 20 years, that the voices will grow louder saying like, hey, miners aren't making much money. An entire premise of Bitcoin is that the security model, we need an incentive, economic incentive for miners. And everyone's like, well, the fee market ain't happening. Everyday money ain't happening. So how do we address this? Well, we change Bitcoin to introduce continuing a tail emission, continuing to pay a subsidy to miners, which would, of course, change the supply cap of 21 million.
There's an
alternative that was discussed at the Quantum Bitcoin event, which is like, well, there's all these like presumed lost coins or these coins that ultimately don't make the transition to post-quantum Bitcoin. So we'll take all those, burn them. I mean, definitely one of the key questions of how to deal with quantum, if we need to deal with quantum, is do we burn these coins that will be stolen by a quantum computer? If we do burn them, one proposal is to take them and recycle them into an incentive program for miners. So that would be a source of tail emission. And the beauty of that is that we're not touching the 21 million.
Right.
But at best, I think that can be argued. I mean, first of all, you can get into the philosophical arguments of burning the coins, but if we just set that aside, assuming everyone's decided we're going to burn the coins. We burn the coins. Now, what do we do to them? Literally keep them burned or recycle. A nice thing about that is that like, okay, great. We aren't touching the 21 million narrative, but it's a stopgap. It's a Band-Aid, right? Because once all that's issued out, then we reach a point again. If there's not Bitcoin network activity, there's not fees. Okay, now we need to expand the 21 million. So it would hurt if that were ever introduced. It would, in my opinion, substantially hurt the credibility of any kind of statement saying like,
yes,
in 50 years, there'll still be this, the same monetary policy as today.
It becomes a theory. Like, I think it kills
to me that like one of the,
you can't compromise
a top
neutrality.
Three, you can argue it's number one, but a top three tenet of Bitcoin is the monetary policy that was set forth on day one is the same as today.
Yeah.
And I can credibly believe that in 50 years, it'll be the same.
Right.
there's a strong, I mean, we're talking about risks to this, right? But we still believe there's a high probability it's going to be the same in 50 years. But it's really important to that, but that's not a guarantee, right? It's not a certainty. Right. It's really important for us to talk about and reason about how could that not be the case. So I think a huge risk is we don't see sufficient Bitcoin network activity. We don't see sufficient fees from transactions. As the subsidy declines towards zero, growing louder voices that will get will be appealing to people will be to change the monetary policy of Bitcoin. And I don't think we want to reach that future, because then if we get to that point too, then investors will be like, what did I invest in again? I thought the normal reason I invested is that doesn't change.
Right.
Yeah. I said this kind of jokingly, but I actually kind of want to double down on this right now, which is that the irony is the most hardcore Bitcoin is money people really probably need the degens, at least short term. I hope we find one of these AI breakout cases. But the reality is Bitcoin got started as gray to dark market money. And if you really want it to survive, no matter what, I'm not saying necessarily dark, but like it should be at least, I mean, in gray areas, that's where Bitcoin thrives. We were talking about last night, like when do you stable coin?
Maybe I didn't interpret your degen. I thought you meant like ordinals and runes.
Okay. I do. I mean that, but to me, that's
there's that, and there's also like dark markets as
yeah,
well.
Yeah. Well, so I'm talking more about the runes and the gray, let's say gray area. But like what I'm saying is like for the people that are like, oh no, it's money and this and that. It's like, dude, the gamblers are the ones who are operating in this like liminal space between what is and is not allowed. And like the gamblers and like the kind of the guys living on the riverboat, those are the ones that keep Bitcoin what it is. Without the riverboat people, I mean, your point that it gets captured and then loses all of its value, like that's a real risk.
Yeah. Well, my optimism, and I know we're kind of running over time now, so we'll draw to a close, but my optimism is that I think there are a billion people who are newly enabled to build things.
Yes.
And they didn't know how to build things before, but they had ideas. Now they're able to build things, and there needs to be money transactions when people build things. Cause like, you know, running these models, there's a cost to, and keeping these things alive. And then the value you create and the things that you build get paid by other people. And so instead of saying like, let's evolve the existing world to use Bitcoin mostly, I think it's great that people do that. But I think the growth and my optimism for the growth and kind of hitting these J curves and kind of these exponentials is that things that could never be built or were not like all of the ideas and the creativity of humanity has not been applied to building the ways that Bitcoin could and would be used. And now we've unlocked that.
Yeah.
That's possible. So like the next, is it 18 months? Is it 24 months? When you have a billion people building applications, some of them are going to figure out interesting things to do with Bitcoin.
Which is why I come back. I agree with you, and I love that optimism. You and Ben are making me feel a lot better. You made me feel a little bit more scared, but I mean, I said this jokingly, but I actually mean it. That's why we need something big like Carpathy to come work on blog. Like, and increasingly getting like the Goose people working with the Bitcoin people. Like, I think that's probably our number one shot at not having this like dystopian future.
Yeah, and I agree. Net, I'm optimistic. I'd probably just quit and work on something else if I thought it was all going to fail, right? So I agree with that point, David. And we just need to like triple down on it.
Make it happen.
We actually have like, we have even more risks to talk about. So we'll tackle that either next week or in a future PBJ episode. It's super important for us to
think through all
the risks, be critical analysis, be honest. So that, both the like, communicate and educate people, hear from people.
Yeah.
Where are we wrong in our analysis? But then also like come up with solutions, right? Which we're already doing, but like improve how we're working to solve
this. One other thought, just while we're on that subject, you've said this many times, and maybe you're even the guy to spearhead this because you're so deep in there. I also agree with you, in addition to just like vibe coding and stuff, increasingly I think it's going to be something with games that like probably young people are embracing. You know, yesterday, without doxing anyone, there was a very sharp young guy who told me he's been to Bitcoin for like 15 years. I'm like, but that would make you like 12. He was like, that's right. And I was like, well, how did you even get started? And the sort of like implication was he'd like steal his dad's passport to get started, right? Uh-huh. So like, I do think the like Skibidi Cash that Block was working on and like all the stuff to get like young people, because young people are also unbanked, right? And like, I mean, I'm becoming a Skibidi maximalist here. Like, I actually think our best shot is—
Just to be clear—
I don't think Block
worked on Skibidi.
Oh, that was.
I think a Block employee may have contributed personally. But.
A Spiral grantee and a Spiral employee worked on the project.
Fair enough. Yeah. Regardless, whoever did it is a legend. And I actually think that's our best shot is like if we get the kids gaming with this stuff. And remember, kids are unbanked. Like this guy's having to steal his dad's passport to participate. Great. There's a market. Like,
yeah, I mean, there's so much energy. You know, you look at Roblox, like if you're a 12-year-old kid, you have no way to earn money. So these 12-year-old kids,
and they're smart. These
build
kids are
a
smart.
Game on Roblox and make money doing that. Like that's actually a credible way, you know, better than a paper route.
And they could probably do a lot better than their parents in the new economy. So
yeah.
So call it.
All right.
That was great show.
Skibbity boys.
Love jamming with you guys.
Good to see you.
All right.
Bye-bye.